Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of July. Steve Gunderson is our guest this part of the show, author of The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. Steve has had a long political career in the Wisconsin State Assembly from 75 to 79, and then representing the state's 3rd congressional district in the U.S. House for 16 years as a moderate Republican. He's now president of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. He spent 9 years as a strategic planning consultant focused on the jobs revolution, and will we ever talk about jobs this hour of the program. He is from, don't you love the name? There should be a song about this if there isn't already, Pleasantville, Wisconsin. His grandfather was a farmer, his father a car dealer, and I believe his father is the only member of the family. It's a large family. Steve has a lot of brothers and sisters still living in Pleasantville. The book looks at an issue that we've been on for a couple weeks now, and that maybe it's time for politicians to be on in a serious way, America's shrinking middle class. And today we focus on how we can reverse that trend through higher education, workforce training, what else? We welcome your phone calls for Steve Gunderson. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, we'd sure like to read them, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Steve Gunderson, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much, Kathleen. Delighted to do it.
I really like the combination here because there's a poetic reminiscence about your growing up in Pleasantville and about your grandfather and your father and your family and what the town meant to you and to all of you, the values it gave you, in addition to a policy prescription, because we can spend a lot of time, and I do want us to spend some time, talking about how things have changed, not for the better, but it's good to talk about what we can do about it. And things have changed in Pleasantville, haven't they?
Well, they sure have. You know, I went, along with my brothers and sisters, we all went to a two-room country school.
Oh.
Obviously, that doesn't exist anymore. My mother and before her, one of my uncles ran a country store. It was what you and I would call Norman Rockwell's definition of a corner in the road in rural America.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have had pretty darn good teachers at that two-room country school.
We were pretty blessed with the teachers we had, no question about it.
And there was, your grandfather was a farmer who I believe it became a car dealer eventually. Your father stayed in that profession. There was a sense that, you know, people worked hard, but they were able to provide for their families.
Yeah, I mean, my grandfather literally was a farmer who during the Depression started a repair shop, which became a used car dealership, which became eventually a new car franchise. And that became the basis for first my dad and my uncles, and then my brothers, and now, believe it or not, some of the nephews being in the car business, both in Wisconsin and in California. So in many ways, I'm the black sheep of the boys in the family because I'm the one that's never had an active duty role in the car dealership.
Hmm. Well, it's not too late.
Thank you.
You can always do that at some point. So as you look at what's happened in the years since, you don't have to go much farther than your family. I think you have just, seven brothers and sisters?
Yeah, and you know, we're so indicative of what I would call the middle class created after World War II, because
right.
My mother was only allowed to go to school through the eighth grade. My father went to school only through high school, and then he went into the war, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
After World War II, the new middle class or modern middle class was created, and that for many families became the first generation that had an opportunity to go to post-secondary education. Every one of my brothers and sisters and I have had some level of post-secondary education. And, you know, now the next generation is pretty significantly, predominantly college graduates. So it's that evolution that occurs in most American families.
Mm-hmm. And yet there are members of your family who are struggling, it would appear to me, to make sure they have a good living for their families. I think your dad's the only person still in Pleasantville. Your family is scattered all over the country. And it's probably been more of a struggle for them to give their children a better life than what your parents were able to give you.
I don't think there's any doubt that our generation has faced challenges. We've certainly faced them in the last decade, and any family with children, I think, has been caught in the declining value of their home, the declining value of their retirement, the, in essence, freeze of wages that we have seen, literally, Kathleen, if you look back, almost to the 1970s, but as I say in my book, we sort of camouflaged that freeze on wages for a number of years. So net worth for families has declined for our generation in ways that it expanded greatly for our parents' generation, and yet we've become accustomed to, should I say, a better quality of life, more opportunities, and as a result, families, all families, I think, or certainly most families, face that challenge of how do we do that with this tension between resources and demand.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the role of politics. And you think about you think about Olympia Snow, two people who are top of mind, who were very effective, very dedicated politicians for a long period of time. And essentially, the political gridlock just got to be too much. And it's not that you're not doing great work outside of the political system. But I want you to address that, because I wonder how much of it is a reason for some of what ails our middle class right now. And if indeed it is the political system that will solve some of these problems, if people could get along with each other.
Well, one of the things that I try to point out in the book is the disappearance of the middle class and its impact on American politics. And what you will see in the studies that I put into the book, Kathleen, is that as we've seen, in essence, a polarization on wages and incomes, we have seen a similar polarization of ideologies. And so that those who are active in politics tend to be, should I say, the strident voices on both the left and the right. And so compromise becomes much more difficult. And I think everyone would say, no matter where you are ideologically, the political center of American politics still exists, but it's not very visible in the halls of elected government today.
Mm-hmm. What's astounding to me, we're kind of on a theme this week. We did the Two American Families, the PBS documentary that focused on Milwaukee that aired last night, and I actually saw it twice. It's just such a powerful film, and I'm so glad that you're focusing attention on this as well. But one of the people in the film, when he's very young, I think he's in high school, and he's watching yet another president being inaugurated, and he says, you know, these people just get up there and they say a lot of stuff to stay on top. And when you look at how long this has been going on, Steve, it really is disheartening that nobody has taken this on in a significant way when there are so many families, you know, are trying to piece together jobs to stay alive, when people have lost benefits, when it's so much harder to be alive in America in a middle class life. And you think, what, all these administrations, who's done anything about it?
Well, in recent years,
yes,
not very
yes,
many, of either side of the aisle, and this isn't me sitting on the outside condemning those that are the inside, and active in politics today, as much as it's trying to do the kind of analysis that I think is nonpartisan, which is really what the goal of this book was, mm-hmm. is recognizing that, as you said earlier in this interview, my parents' generation succeeded through hard work and good basic values. Hard work by itself today simply doesn't cut it. It will not get you the kind of opportunities, the wages, the incomes that you need right. to have middle-class life. And I mean, we have seen, for example, that post-secondary education is absolutely necessary right. to have the income levels that are going to give you that opportunity for middle-class life. But we don't really talk about today how do we design and deliver access to post-secondary education in a way that is viable for the diversity of the American workforce, and that is everybody from adults who need to go back to school because their plant closed or their skills are outdated, to young people, especially from low-income families, who say, you know, I'm just not going to take out that kind of debt
right.
when I don't know what is the light at the end of the tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are seeing a real challenge. I don't think, and this is just a personal feeling, but I do discuss it in the book. Yes, there is an increased income disparity in America. It's not as significant as I think our politicians have made it from time to time. But what I wish everybody would agree on is that the potential for upward mobility economically has really vanished. It's a rare, rare exception to every rule if an individual can climb that economic ladder from the lower levels of family income to a higher level for themselves and their family.
So how do we get to college?
Well, I think there are a couple things you got to do here. First of all, one of the things I mentioned in the book is that we really need to have a serious conversation about pre-K-14. Now, yeah, I mean, we talk about universal kindergarten through 12th grade, K-12 right now. That's not enough in the world in which we're going. America today is 16th in the world in the per capita number of people with associate degrees. So we're falling way behind at that level of what would be midterm post-secondary education. We have got to, if we could give everybody 2 years of post-secondary education, we would give them the skills that would open the doors for them to be a part of the middle class. How do you finance that? Well, I'm not going to say that government just taxes and spends the money, because I know that that's not politically going to happen. One of the things I talk about in the book is literally a public-private philanthropic partnership. And I try to lift up the fact that we know over the next 40 to 50 years, there will be a intergenerational transfer of wealth in this country of $71 trillion, not billion, not million, trillion with a T, dollars in this country. If we don't capture a small percentage of that for philanthropy and use that in combination with public-private partnerships, we're not going to provide the access that that next generation needs.
Mm-hmm. So who are all those people who have that money? Are those people who built those solid middle-class lives and now they've been able to accumulate wealth?
Believe it or not, no. Of course, they exist.
I mean,
there's no question. The Bill and Melinda Gateses of the world absolutely exist. But the concern I have is that there are an awful lot of individuals across even Wisconsin who have the potential to make a 5% contribution of their net worth into a community-wide regional foundation in a way that would create real resources. And in my book, I actually use Trumplo County as an example. We're not one of the highest wage-based counties in all of Wisconsin. And yet, there's no doubt that over a 10-year period, we could create an endowment that would have a significant impact on the lives of people within that county.
Mm-hmm. And what about Congress? Now, how do you move off where they are right now with being far apart on student loans for the people who need the student loans the most? Those rates are doubled at this point in time. That's no way to get everybody a college education, is it?
No. I mean, there are a couple things, and I was actually on a panel this morning sponsored by the National Journal on the next generation of higher education. And I shared with them, Kathleen, that when I was in Congress, we talked about Pell Grants as being the vehicle for access to post-secondary education and student loans as being the vehicle for choice. In other words, if I needed money to have the ability to go to UW-Eau Claire, UW-La Crosse, et cetera, a Pell Grant would give me that access. But if I said, you know what, I want to go to a more expensive school, a private university, whatever the case might be, that the loan would be that vehicle which would move me from access to choice. That's not the case anymore. We are looking at the fact today that because of college costs, loans by themselves to fund education are simply unacceptably high, and they're putting debts on students that, A, first and foremost, convince them not to pursue that
right.
post-secondary education, and secondly, burden them with debt in the years beyond that. So we've got to, when we reauthorize the Higher Education Act, we have got to drive more of that money to what you and I would call low-income families in those most needy through Pell Grant programs and the like to provide a really honest definition of access in this decade.
We're going to go to phone calls in just a moment. Let's look at the. Let's talk more about philanthropy here and about the role of corporate America in all of this. We, as you well know, are living at a time when corporations are being blasted for moving their operations overseas, for downsizing, for in some measure creating part of the problem that you've been outlining. You write that you remain a huge believer in the emerging role of philanthropy as the neutral and long-term convener. You hope that American philanthropic organizations will convene a conversation through their national associations, through their states, and through community foundations and family foundations, corporate grant-making programs. Is there enough of that in place to make a difference? What are your hopes in that area?
My hope is that the resources that are there would be, should I say, not only accessed but leveraged in ways that would make a difference. And clearly in the book, I am calling for philanthropy to understand that it has to play a more significant role in the investment of the future of not only its communities, but the citizens of its community. And clearly that opportunity is there, but I don't think the understanding in the role they can play exists. I mean, if I was universally wealthy, I would create a foundation to promote the creation of foundations.
Great.
I really think we need that in this country. And the number of people, Kathleen, both individually and corporately, who literally experience, should I say, the transfer of wealth without ever allocating even a small percentage of that to philanthropy is really a tragedy in American society.
We go to phone calls. Stephen Gunderson is our guest. He has a new book, The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. He is now the president and CEO of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities. He was the former president of the Council on Foundations, long political career, as you know, in Wisconsin in the State Assembly, and then representing the state's third congressional district in Congress, 16 years in the U.S. House, where he worked on a variety of issues, education, employment policy, human rights issues, decided not to seek re-election in 1996. So how do we create the new middle class? How's that for a subject? Here's the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. You can send us a Twitter if you'd like, at K Dunn Show, or leave messages on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Steve Gunderson, our guest, he writes in his book, The New Middle Class, he writes about his grandfather and his parents and his middle class values and says, maybe we can't and should not return to that era. Technology, global economy, and the mobility of today's families all suggest that times have indeed changed, but we can seek to extend to a new generation the opportunities, values, and benefits of an American middle class life. That's what we're talking about this hour of the show. We start our calls for Steve with Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi. Hey, I got it seems like high school is the perfect vehicle to get people engaged, get them a trade, and move them on into the real world. It seems like very few people need to go on to the UW wherever or Harvard and get a PhD. It seems like the students would be more engaged if they could learn something that they could actually use, and you'd have a captive audience, and just forget going on to a second education. Like, what are your thoughts on that,
Steve?
Sure. Well, it's a logical question. Unfortunately, the hiring practices of America today suggest that it's not a viable option in terms of where we're going to go, because the high school degree by itself simply will not result in the kind of hiring and the kind of wages that are going to be necessary for a middle class. Let me just give you an example. The average middle class, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, is roughly $66,000 for a family of four. Now, if you have a high school education, the average annual earnings are in the low to mid $30,000. So if you have two-wage earner, you're going to be right at the bottom of that opportunity there. So in order to get incomes that are going to give you that opportunity to participate in today's definition of a middle class, you've simply got to have a skill set that's going to earn you a higher wage.
Thank you very much, Chris, for your call. And what about those other jobs, though? What about the responsibility of corporations to retrain workers? We, for decades now, have been talking about making sure that the skills are where the jobs are.
We have seen a significant level of corporate investment in education and training. It's in the billions of dollars. And actually, I've got the number in the book, and I can't tell it to you right now, Kathleen, without looking it up. But the reality is that if you would combine that with philanthropy, and if we would see corporate America better partnering with our community colleges and our other private sector colleges, et cetera, in the delivery of that training, we will get the resources where everybody wins.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know if this is the figure you were looking for, private business today invests over $150 billion in employee training each year. That's a lot of money.
There you go. That's the number, right. So yeah. It's a significant amount. And part of what I wanted to say in the book is that I don't want this to be a conversation about is there enough tax dollars today. I believe there's enough public and private resources that we can have very bold proposals.
We go to James in Belvedere. Hi, James.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Anyway, my concept would be a policy concept to put money back in the hands of the people that are making earned income. As long as you're paying into the system, you're supporting schools, bridges, you call up all the infrastructure. So why don't we concentrate on giving that tax-paying homeowner, as long as he owns a home, he qualifies for a debit card, $2,000-$3,000 that he can tie with his own savings, tie it with a bank loan if he can get one. And he just can't buy anything with his debit card. He has to use it within a 1 or 2 year period. But he can buy anything that's manufactured, produced, and sold retail in this country that brings appreciable value back to his property. Now you're raising real equity levels, and then you do that in a 20-year cycle, so every 2 years. You're going to create jobs for people that don't even have a house. I mean, you're going to create a manufacturing base, a river of opportunity that any entrepreneur can go throw his line in and say, I'm going to go to America. They got X amount of dollars guaranteed up front for the home improvement maintenance business. And if you need a loan, the bank's going to say, here's a loan. You're in a home improvement maintenance business? Here's a loan, because you become a good risk to the bank. So pretty soon that window manufacturer is going to have to hire an engineer, get a bulldozer, buy some steel. You know, it's going to help other sectors of the economy.
All right, Steve.
Hey, he's actually right. There are a couple numbers from my book that I think are helpful for everyone to understand. Between 1997 and 2006, we had an 84% increase in the value of, or the price of homes, which became obviously home equity for Americans. And what we saw on the reverse side of that, when we saw the bubble of the housing bubble crash, is the average family's home was 70% of the family assets in 1970. It was down to between 30 and 40% in 2008. Mm. So the home is an critical, essential part in getting the, quote, net worth or the wealth that enables families to have that middle-class standard of living.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, James, for your call and for your enthusiasm. I like it. Mary Beth in Heartland. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a quick question. When you talk about getting money to create philanthropy and people to get educated, educational jobs, why can't the United States, if we have such a downturn in our economy, go to the IMF and ask them for about $20 million to subsidize some of these programs. They just lent $52 million to Pakistan for education, for energy, for programs.
Well, the problem we would have is that we can ask. I don't think the IMF is going to give us the money. And I think most Americans actually are at the point where we want to chart our own future. We don't want to be dependent, whether it be on Middle East oil or it be on the IMF to do it. And I think there are opportunities for us to do this on our own without being dependent on others. You know, when you go to the IMF or the World Bank or things like that, what you are getting is a loan. You're not getting a grant.
Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about retirement for a moment, which, and you talk about our incomes after retirement, pension programs, et cetera, retirement security. Can we discuss a little how many people have lost that security over the past decade, and what do we do, Steve, to restore it?
Well, it's one of those things, Kathleen, that I mentioned in the book in terms of what I call the so-called cover-up of the demise of the middle class. And it refers to this whole issue of moving in our retirement programs from what you and I would call pension programs that were guaranteed benefit programs rather than guaranteed contribution, defined contribution programs. And it was literally between the mid-70s and the turn of the century where we didn't only see 3,400 underfunded pensions go out of business. We saw literally 165,000 adequately funded pension programs go out of business.
Wow.
And what that has done is it has said to individuals, quote, your pensions or your retirement income is up to you. Good luck.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do about that?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things which in this case, the policymakers are going to have serious conversations. There are ways in which we can return to a much more defined benefit pension program that is, in essence, a combination of contributions and money markets and so-called secure investments that would provide more of a retirement income. The second thing is to recognize and really engage in some kind of a serious national conversation about what do we do with 401ks and those kind of programs. What we have today is the average 401k in 2010 is $26,900, and if you had a $60,000 IRA, that would give you $300 a month. So if you're at $24,000, you can quickly see that that's less than $150
right.
of retirement benefits per month.
Mm-hmm.
That, combined with what you get in Social Security today, is not enough for most retirees.
No, it's not. It's a huge issue, and it hasn't been sufficiently addressed, has it?
I don't think it has. We all talk about underfunding Medicare and the challenges of Social Security, but what we don't talk about is how do we design and deliver a system that will enable and empower ordinary Americans to participate in the creation of appropriate personal retirement programs for themselves.
Yeah. Steve Gunderson, our guest this hour, his book is The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity for the 21st Century. Let's go to Mike in Franklin. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Hey, I'm a grandfather, and what I feel is I'm not only letting my children and my grandchildren down, I'm letting my grandparents and my parents down. They gave me a country. They gave us a country where people like me, we could go out. I tried college. It didn't work. I was able to get into a halfway decent job and raise my four children. And what we're saying now, and even you are saying, Mr. Gunderson, is we need all this advanced education where for 50 to 60% of the jobs in this country, whether you work in a driving a truck or working in a factory or these things, you don't need specialized education. So what are we supposed to do, throw 50 or 60% of the people away and say you don't have a chance at the middle class? It doesn't make any sense to me. What we need to do is we need people like me need to get behind the young people and say, guess what, the minimum wage should be doubled. We got to put this country back where people feel like what they're working for means something. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, I wish it were as easy as Mike is saying, and what Mike has shared with us is the reality is that individuals like himself, through a lot of hard work and dedication, were able to succeed in my parents' generation. What I'm simply sharing with you is that that is not the way the clouds align for the next generation of individuals. We are looking at roughly 30% of our workforce will require some level of post-secondary education certificates up to AA degrees. That's roughly 40 million people in 2010. The projections are it's going to be 49 million people in 2020, so there's going to be a 9 million increase. When you look at the country in 2020, we're looking at 55 million new jobs. Now, the problem with that, Kathleen, is that 23 million of those jobs are brand new jobs, and 85% of those brand new jobs that don't exist today are going to require post-secondary education, and 32 million are replacing people like me, baby boomers, mm-hmm. who will retire. And of those, 65% of those jobs will require post-secondary education. These aren't Steve Gunderson's ideas or political philosophy. This is the work from the best labor demographers we have in this country that have looked at the situation. And what I tried to do in the book was research and find that information and bring it all together in one place.
Hmm. Let's look at the global nature of this, which you do in your book. It's where things can get, it seems like a little complicated, and some will feel that it's out of our hands. You raise this question, and I wonder how you answer it, Steve Gunderson. And it's raised by those who study, you write, the emerging global middle class, whether the middle class can grow elsewhere and in the United States at the same time.
Well, I think it can if we have a global growth economy. I mean, one of the areas where I would ideologically disagree significantly is what has been going on in Europe, where they have tried to suggest that cuts in government are sufficient to balance their economic needs. It's just not viable. I mean, the reality is you cannot provide a viable middle class either in America or around the world unless you have 4 to 5% annual GNP growth. When we're looking at 1 to 2% growth, we don't have sufficient growth to create the jobs that Mike and other people were talking about.
Mm-hmm. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the companies that had left the United States over the past 10 and 20 years. It's been a significant change, of course. Can you still grow a middle class with that kind of fundamental change toward a global economy, toward hiring workers who live in Bangladesh and in China and in Mexico, in countries that pay less money? Tell me how that all factors into what has happened and how difficult it may make it for what you would like to see happen.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it could take us 2-3 hours. I mean, when we talk about middle class income in America ranging from $40,000 to $80,000 for a family of four, you know, that's a pretty big disparity depending on where you live within this country, urban, rural, north, south, etc. When you talk about middle income globally, it's important to understand that it is middle income purchasing power in that nation or region's economy. And when you look at the data, as I include in the book, you will see a dramatic growth of the middle class in Asia Pacific. You will see a dramatic decrease in the middle class in Europe, and you'll see a minor decrease in the middle class in North America. But no one is going to suggest that the middle class in Asia Pacific is going to be monetarily equal to the wages earned by the middle class in North America. What it is going to be is a middle class wage for their middle class, for their economy.
More phone calls for Steve Gunderson momentarily. No stranger, of course, to Wisconsin. Longtime politician from Wisconsin. Wisconsin State Assembly in the 70s and then quite a number of years in the U.S. House of Representatives, where he represented the 3rd Congressional District. He is now the president and CEO of the Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities, former president of the Council on Foundations, and author of The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. How do we do that? And here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655 is our phone line, and we have a couple lines open for you right now. You can also send us a message at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And tomorrow, during this time period, we'll be talking about today's failed Senate vote on student loans, and we will look at the cost of higher education in this country and compare it with the rest of the world. Should be a really interesting conversation, and a little more added to what we've been talking about this hour with Steve Gunderson, who remains with us until the top of the hour, author of The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. Pam in Madison is next. Hi, Pam.
Hi, Kathleen. I was wanting to talk about the role of the federal government in supporting the middle class. A lot of baby boomers' parents got a kickstart when the GI Bill subsidized their college education. And now college educations are entirely personally funded, which does not kickstart wealth from an early age. It detracts from wealth at an early age.
Steve.
Well, you're absolutely right in the first part. I mean, there's no question that the middle class can give as much credit to the GI Bill's contribution as anything else in terms of that kickstart. Where I would disagree with you is on the amount of the federal government's role in college education today. I think the total financial aid programs at the federal level exceed $150 billion a year. So there's a significant contribution. But, of course, we're in a very different era when we have many, many more individuals going to school, where we have the tuition and the cost of higher education so much greater than it was right after World War II. And so what we don't have is the right symmetry between numbers, costs, and federal monies available. And that's why we need to look at additional resources.
Well, you even, this chart that you have several charts, but this chart that looks at net college costs as a percentage of median family income, four-year public colleges and university, lowest income quintile from 99 to 2000 was 39%, 2007 to 2008, 55%. How in the world are you supposed to pay for college? That's huge.
You can't, and that's the challenge today, is college costs, right or wrong, fair or unfair, have increased so much faster than the rate of inflation or certainly the rate of individuals' ability to pay for it, that we've got to deal with this issue of access to post-secondary
right.
education today.
Yeah, we do. Well, Pam, thank you. Mike in Iowa, hi.
Good morning, or afternoon. I don't have an answer for the problem, but I do have a couple of comments I would like to make.
Sure.
When I'm done, I'll take my answers off the air. Number one, when I'm listening to the program, I get this vision of the middle class, and I get that every time I hear the media talk about it, as though they're young, upwardly mobile, white-collar, junior execs. Now, that's just the picture I get. Mentally when I'm listening to this program. And I think that all too often we forget about the carpenters and the bricklayers and the excavators and the truck drivers, as one fellow mentioned. Secondly, in regards to college, all of my kids, we did manage to pay for all 5 kids' college. We gave them 4 years. However, I have gotten to know some of their friends that went to college with them, and many of them are saddled with a mountain of college debt. Now, I don't believe that the answer is for the federal government to step in and say, well, here, we'll give another handout for college. I think that sometimes, and at some point, economically, we're going to have to look at that. Maybe college is not all the answer. when they come out of college at 22, 23 years old, find a life partner and say, well, I want to get married now, but we and buy a house, but we have, you know, $1,000 a month in student loan payments. Mm-hmm. And to saddle someone at that age with that seems just utterly insane to me when they're just beginning their life. And I would like to hear the comments on that and take my answer.
Thank you,
here.
Mike. Thank you for your thoughtful comments. Steve.
Yeah, first of all, the gentleman is absolutely right on the first half of his comments because, and if I have not indicated that the trades in those type of professions absolutely have a role in the middle class, then I've not spoken properly. There's a significant opportunity there for those trades. Even skilled manufacturing is coming back to America for all the right reasons, and we should not undervalue that opportunity to middle-class life in America over the next 10 to 20 years. It's significant. But what I do want to point out, and again, don't blame the messenger here, folks, as much as the guy who did the research and looked at the data that other people and is sharing that, and that is that those with simply a high school degree, we are seeing that job growth over the last year has been down 14% for people with high school or less. We have seen an increase for those with some college or associate's degree, and we have seen a significant increase for those with a bachelor's degree or above. And so, fair or unfair, the job market today is demanding some level of education and slash career skills in the hiring and certainly in the wages that are paid.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Greg in Fenimore. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My idea basically is for creating resources, why aren't we tying income tax to funding education? Basically, my idea is that the more education that you get, typically the more income you're going to create and you're going to end up paying back into the system to create those resources necessary for funding those changes. To me, it's a much better way to fund it, and it ties much more closely than any other way that I can think of to create those resources.
Yeah. I'm one who is such a big fan and supporter of investments in education that I would personally probably support that, but I can tell you that the Congress as a whole would be hesitant to start ever allocating taxes to a direct program because you and I might like education, people in Texas might like defense, people in another state might like conservation and the environment, and that you just can't run the government in that way. Where we can do this, which I think is a sort of an adjustment of what you're saying, is go to income-based repayment of student loans. And actually, the association which I'm running is one of those that has advocated that when the Congress reauthorized the Higher Education Act, we take the Australian or the Canadian model. Australia is the best-known example here, where all student loan repayments are based on wages earned that year, and they're deducted from your wages, so there's no such thing as a default. In the Australian system, if you earn under $40,000 in a given year, you don't pay anything on your loan repayment that year. Then at $40,000, it goes up roughly 4% or 8% every $4,000 up to $80,000 when you would pay 8 to 10% of your income on your loan repayment. So it's always based on the ability to pay of the wage earner based on their salaries that year, the same way we withhold income tax.
Well, why don't we do that here?
Well, we're suggesting, and I think there's a better than 50-50 chance. Right now, what we have at the federal level, Kathleen, is you can sign up for that program for a year. Mm. Then you got to re-sign up again. And what we need to do is go to a universal program where everyone who has a loan will have an income-based repayment program. And actually, Congressman Tim Petri from Wisconsin is the primary author of this kind of a proposal in front of the Congress.
Huh. Thank you, Greg, for your call. Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good afternoon. Hello, Steve. I just compliment you for the good work you did while you served in Congress, particularly under the Title III programs, and I have the privilege to work with you on that, that's post-secondary programs, is one who monitored student debt 25 years ago. Rarely did a student graduate from UW-Eau Claire with more than $3,500 in debt. But we were able to kind of package aid, the Pell Grant, work study, and loans, and the students who are from least-income families got more grants than students from upper-income families. And I do support the idea now of the Australian model. That's exactly what we need to do, and I'll be seeing Congressman Petrie next week, and I'll reinforce that.
Oh.
I appreciate that, and tell him hi from me, and he certainly knows we support what he's trying to do.
Exactly. And by the way, Steve was the whip for the Republican Party, the whip, rather, for Gingrich. And I think he had a better arm reaching across the aisle than he did a hand for the whip.
Well, one of the beauties of representing a competitive state legislative district and a competitive congressional district, I couldn't survive if I didn't have independent and Democrat votes. And I tell people that was a gift, because I think it created a value system that America needs today. We have got to be able to work across partisan aisles together for the good of the country. It's not the interests of the party. It's the outcomes for America or for the state.
Hit it right on, and we've got to work in that direction. And I don't know how to get it done, but let's hope.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the call, Bob. Is that the subject of the next book, Steve? How do you do that?
We haven't gotten that far, Kathleen.
Okay. Thanks, Bob, for the call. A couple lines are open, and we have time to take a couple more phone calls if you would like to avail yourselves of the opportunity. 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and Steve Gunderson is our guest. His book is The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. Joan in Eau Claire, hi.
Good afternoon. Perhaps the two of you may recall this from the primary portion of the 2012 presidential campaign. Candidate Rick Santorum went on the record saying, "You don't need a college degree. You can work with your hands." I strongly disagree with Santorum. A college education should remain available to all U.S. citizens, not just the wealthy. Let's remember Santorum was a presidential candidate. His comment does not reassure me that he, Santorum, nor his party, is on board for higher education for all U.S. citizens. I'm just wondering about your comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan.
Well, one of the important things to sort of say as a disclaimer, in my present job, I am very nonpartisan. I work with people on both sides of all the aisles, and that's sort of a directive from my board, but my history is also part of my legacy of who I am. That being said, I would simply disagree with Senator Santorum that the majority of Americans don't need some level of post-secondary education. There will always be a component of jobs in this country that don't require post-secondary education. And our concern, however, has to be that we can't have twice as many people pursuing those jobs as they are available. In a knowledge-based, high-tech, information-based economy, the reality is that the vast majority of jobs are going to continue to demand some level of post-secondary education. And as I said earlier, if we have any hope of creating a modern middle class, the Bureau of Labor Statistics are so indicative of what income differentials are based upon education attainment that we've got to promote that education. If you have an associate degree, you will earn between $400,000 and $500,000 more in annual income than someone with just a high school degree. If you have a Bachelor of Arts degree or Bachelor of Science degree, you will earn over $900,000 more over your life. That's the average number. I mean, some people earn a lot more than that than you would with just a high school degree. So the reality is the numbers are there, and what we have to individually and collectively do is decide whether or not we want to pursue that education attainment as the bridge to opportunity.
Mm. Let's talk just a little bit. We only have a minute left. Alas, there are parts of the book we never got to. But I always read the dedication of books, and you dedicate this to your family, who gave you a middle-class life, middle-class opportunities, and middle-class values. What were the values, Steve? And do you worry that we've lost some of those?
You know, one of the values is community. one of the values is family. I call those kind of things universal commitments. You know, I may live in Washington, D.C., and I may travel the country all the time now, but my family is still my family, and when someone is sick or someone is in need, I would like to think that I am there for them. I think the sense of community that we grew up with is not a universal sense in today's mobile society. I can guarantee you it's not the same sense of community that we have in an urban area like Washington, D.C. So I think those are certainly a couple of them. I think respect for each other. You know, I grew up in an area where we didn't know what people's partisan positions or labels were, and mm-hmm. we didn't even know how much they earned. Hmm. I never chose a friend based on the income of their family. I had no idea what it was. And there was something that was wonderful about that lack of knowledge that would segment us into a class society.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Steve Gunderson, the book is The New Middle Class, Creating Wealth, Wages, and Opportunity in the 21st Century. It is a thoughtful examination of all that ails the middle class, and there's a lot that ails the middle class these days. Steve Gunderson is the current president, CEO of the Association of Private Sector Colleges. He, of course, was in the state assembly for a few years in the 70s, and then the state's third congressional district he represented in Washington for 16 years. Did a lot of work on education, employment policy, and human rights issues. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program. Thanks for your calls, everybody. Very thoughtful calls, as always. You're a good audience. Stay tuned for Central Time. We'll be with you tomorrow at 1:00.